On some mornings, I step outside before pulling on any socks or sliding my feet into their shoes. The soil presses up against my bare feet and shapes itself to them. The clumped grasses massage and wake up my soles.
David Abram, reading from his book Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology.
My steps slow down further. Flat rocks and rough rocks, needles cast off by the pines, grit that clings between the toes as they flex against the land. My feet are like ears listening downward. Try this when the mood strikes you. Step out upon the solid earth without the intermediary of a rubber or leather sole. Notice the way your feet, pressing against the coarse ground, are also being met by that ground. Watch how spontaneously your feet relax their pace in order to respect this odd otherness, an old ancestral affinity between the human foot and the solid ground is replenished by the simple act of stepping outside without shoes.
An excerpt from David Abram's book, Becoming Animal. Abram is an environmental philosopher. You might call him an animist because he finds a living presence, not just in people or even animals, but also in rocks, wind, even houses. Now, I should add, there's nothing supernatural about what Abram's talking about. He's not invoking elves or nature spirits. But he does think nature's alive in ways we barely notice. Steve Paulson talked with Abram about what it means to become animal.
Do you think many of us have lost the ability to experience the world simply through our senses, not just in our mind?
I do. When we think today, it tends to be a fairly abstract cogitation that unfolds entirely in our skull and has very little to do with stones, buildings, animals, the wind, the clouds overhead.
Let me follow up on that because, I mean, you are invoking, it seems to me, a really radical rethinking of how we see the world. I mean, an animist view that perhaps was the way most of our ancestors thought for many generations, but certainly is hardly experienced anymore. And obviously, there are lots of skeptics about this way of thinking. In fact, at one point you write, confronted with animistic styles of discourse, most of us moderns can only imagine it as a sort of childlike ignorance, a credulous projection of human-like feelings onto mountains and rivers, which surely amounts to madness for any adult soul. Rocks alive? Yeah, right. Are you talking about this in a metaphorical sense or as something more?
I think there is something more than a metaphor here. It cannot be sheer coincidence that virtually every indigenous oral culture that we still know of all share in common this animistic propensity to think of the surrounding material world as something that is alive through and through. It's quite clear that this was the style of perception common to our own indigenous ancestors.
But a lot of people would say that was people believed that way, still do in some cultures, because they lacked a certain scientific understanding. As you put it in your book, you say that a lot of intellectuals in particular kind of write off this way of thinking as overly romantic and backward-looking nostalgia.
Well, I think they're dead wrong. When we speak of cultures as diverse as the Koyukon people of Alaska or the Hopi and the Navajo or Diné people of the Southwest, here where I'm speaking to you, or the Warani or the Kayapo people of the Amazon basin, we're speaking of cultures that are traditionally oral cultures, that is to say, cultures that have developed and thrived for many, many generations, century after century, without a formal system of writing.
And that's an important point for you. You think that something changes once a culture develops the written word, once a culture has an alphabet.
Indeed. Well, once a culture has a formal writing system of any sort, once language is written on the page, then the page becomes the primary mnemonic or memory trigger for remembering stories. Writing is a kind of magic. That is to say, it has a potency, a power to affect and influence our senses that cannot be explained by a purely rational take on things. As soon as we glance at a printed word, we hear it speak. We see what it says instantly. It speaks to us. That's a kind of magic.
And you make the point that there were profound philosophical and spiritual implications to the power of the written word. I mean, you say that monotheism could only rise in a culture with an alphabet, because only that way could we develop an understanding of God entirely outside the physical world.
I think everything that we now conventionally call Western civilization might more precisely be spoken of as alphabetized civilization. And the three peoples of the book, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, the monotheistic religions are very much informed and, I believe, made possible by this new technology or magic that captures, in a sense, the human voice, tracing it out on the scroll or on the page, a voice that seemed to live outside of time entirely, hence outside of the visible, audible, sensorial terrain.
Now, you've used the word magic a number of times, both when you're talking about the power of words, the written word, as well as the way indigenous people see the world. And it's worth pointing out that you are a magician, conjurer, who challenges the way we perceive the world. How has this influenced your thinking?
My first profession was that of a sleight-of-hand magician. I performed in clubs and venues throughout the United States. At a certain point, I ventured to travel as an itinerant magician into Southeast Asia, into more remote village areas within Sri Lanka, within Indonesia, within the high mountains of Nepal.
So what would you do? Just start performing some tricks as you were walking down a village road?
No. Well, at first, I began in that way when I stepped into the less developed world. But I quickly discovered that this was not helpful because huge crowds would gather around me. And so I was unable to meet the traditional magicians that I was interested in finding and learning from.
By traditional magicians, you're talking about the shamans.
I'm talking about those folks we now tend to call shamans, though that's a term that derives from a few cultures in northern Siberia. I tend to feel that the word shaman has been overused and sort of sold down the river, become over-commercialized. And so I use the term magician, traditional magicians, to speak of these folks who are often the healers, the primary healers in their region.
Let's talk about this in a more concrete sense, because you have a remarkable story about an experience you had in the Himalayas, in the mountains of Nepal. You spent some time with, sounds like a very powerful traditional magician you call Sonam. Can you tell me about him? What attracted you to him?
It was apparent from some of the rumors that had reached my ears that this was an uncommonly gifted and skilled magician or shaman. There, the term is Dzongkri. He was one of probably the most powerful Dzongkri I encountered in my travels in that part of the world. But what was most startling to me when I met him was how my own bodily organism began to feel very strange, even as I was just approaching the area where he lived. When I finally met Sonam, and my translator, my Sherpa translator, was so unnerved by meeting him that he insisted that he could not translate for me, and
he thought there was some demonic force there.
I don't know if he felt it as a demonic force, but for his culture, there is a sense that such magicians need to be respected and not come too close to, not intruded upon, because there's something quite dangerous about this kind of power. But when I met this man, what struck me was that I was coming into the presence of a human animal.
you tell a remarkable story after you had gotten to know him and you were working with him. There was one time when you and he were hiking back up a mountain trail, and he was a bit ahead of you, and he seemed to turn into a bird, into a raven. Can you describe that experience?
We were hiking back along a very narrow trail that wound along the side of a very precipitous mountain slope. And at one point in the trail, he rounded a bend up in front, and I couldn't see him for a stretch. As I approached that same bend, I heard the croak of a raven. And then as I came around the bend, I saw this raven perched on a large boulder jutting out to the left of the trail above the river gorge beneath. And this raven was squawking a couple times as it looked at me and blinked and squawked again. And then the raven leapt or hopped off the rock down onto the trail. And as it did so, it seemed first to be flying straight into my face, and my hands flew up as if to protect me. But then it landed on the trail, except the sound was too loud for it to be just the raven landing on the trail. And as I blinked, this small raven turned out to be a person. It was Sonam himself, but he was standing much farther down the trail than I had thought the raven. I thought the raven was really a few feet from me, but it was more 25 feet down the trail. Was Sonam now standing in the trail, looking much smaller than he would have if he was just, 8 or 10 feet away. But I was stunned, and he took off down in front of me again, and I thought, I must have just imagined this. But then he turned, and he cocked his head, looking at me, and he squawked, a perfect series of raven's caws. And I realized that I had just witnessed a transformation of a human into a bird, and back again.
You write about how he then gave you various exercises to do to essentially experience the world like a raven. I mean, very rigorous exercises to almost call up a raven to come and visit you and then stare at a certain part of a raven, and then eventually you seem to fly like a raven.
I was watching a raven very, very intently and placing my focus not just on the back of its neck, but sinking the focus of my eyes into its body and trying to bring my other senses, my tactile and visceral senses, to bear over there where my eyes were focused in the body of this other bird, so that when the bird hopped and then spread its wings and took off, I quite unexpectedly found myself aloft and soaring over the river gorge with this bird. Again, it was completely unexpected, but it was an experience that dramatically changed my life and my sense of what the human body is capable of and what our senses and human perception is capable of.
David Abram is a cultural ecologist and environmental philosopher. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Science Be Sacred? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.